from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, passengers aboard the Grand Princess cruise ship being held off the coast south of San Francisco are waiting for the results of novel coronavirus tests taken from 45 people. Meantime, a Sunnyvale resident who was a former passenger on that cruise ship has died. And emergency workers who perform CPR on the man are self-isolating. We get the latest local developments related to COVID-19. Then, as part of Forum's first-person series, we meet Ton Hall, who is working to change use of force laws against people with mental illness in the name of her son, Miles, who was killed by Walnut Creek police. Forum is next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Santa Clara County public health officials say there are now 23 confirmed cases of the new coronavirus there. Some of those infections are of unknown origin, meaning they could be a result of community spread. Meantime, results are expected today of novel coronavirus tests taken from 45 people on a cruise ship being held about 70 miles southwest of San Francisco. This week, a Placer County man who was on the cruise ship on its previous run to Mexico died of COVID-19, and two Sonoma County residents who were on the same trip have tested positive. Coronavirus test results for a Sunnyvale man who was on the cruise and died are also being processed. We take stock of the latest developments related to the virus in the Bay Area with KQED's Kevin Stark. He's a reporter for KQED Science. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Also with us is Dr. David Relman, professor of medicine and of microbiology and immunology at Stanford University. Good morning, David Relman.
Good morning.
So, Kevin, I'll start with you. First, we're getting reports that worldwide coronavirus cases have now topped 100,000, but what are you hearing?
Well, the latest situation report from the World Health Organization has that number at 95,000. So, but obviously, this is a very fluid situation. Confirmation is coming in all the time. Press reports are coming in all the time. But that's the latest situation report we have from world health officials.
And in terms of the national and local overall numbers, what are you hearing there?
So in the U.S., we now have 99 confirmed cases, and there's also been 14 confirmed deaths from the coronavirus. In California, we're at 60 confirmed cases. Again, this is fluid. That's going to change probably within the hour. And overall, around the world, we have about 3,200 people who have died from the virus.
So, Kevin, what's the latest on the cruise ship that's south of San Francisco? Princess Cruises says samples from the 45 tests taken on the ship were delivered to a state health lab in Richmond?
In Richmond, yeah. That happened yesterday. We are going to get the results of those tests today. Meanwhile, the Grand Princess is trolling off the coast of California between Monterey and San Francisco. All the people that are on the ship, the passengers, have been told to stay in their rooms. And so they're kind of in a holding pattern and just waiting for information.
And anybody who's been on a cruise ship and knows how small some of those rooms are, that cannot be a happy group of people. Dr. David Relman, when the results do come back, and if they do come back positive, what should people do? What should the folks who are working on the ship, what should the officials who are trying to figure out a response plan do?
Well, it's of course a complicated situation, but there are some basics that I think are true in all of these situations. One is people who are infected need to now be put in true isolation, meaning moved away from those who are believed not to be infected. And second, anybody who would seem to be at risk of having now picked up this infection and perhaps doesn't yet know it needs to be identified as such. They too need to be properly quarantined. So I think a much better, assessment of what exactly is going on in a place like that, and then prudent measures to keep the virus from further spreading.
We're hearing that there are some 3,000 plus people on that ship. I mean, tests were taken on 45 people. Why just 45? Is that an effective number, Dr. Relman?
Probably not. Probably not. The problem right now is that we know what we need to learn. We need to learn where is this virus exactly, in whom, in what amounts, at what point in time with respect to a possible disease or illness. Is it in the environment immediately around them? And then what does that say about who is at risk for transmitting and who is at risk for acquiring. That's going to require a much greater capacity for routine point-of-contact tracing and testing. We know how to do that. We just don't yet have the resources deployed to do it at the scale that it really needs to be done now.
Is it your guess that they were only doing 45 tests because so few tests are on hand right now, that we have a shortage of test kits here in the U.S.?
That's my guess. It seems as though the numbers of tests available right now, especially to public health, is in the hundreds and maybe low thousands if we're lucky. But it really needs to be in the tens of thousands and higher. And that's where public-private partnerships are going to play a big role. There are already efforts right now to deploy tests in local healthcare settings. Stanford, for example, my home institution, and the VA here both have tests that are now ready to go, and plenty of other healthcare settings that have a history of developing tests of this sort on the fly can do so and will be doing so, including the commercial sector.
Well, can you take a moment to just talk about why testing early and often is so important for a virus like coronavirus?
So it comes down to some really basic issues, and you might label them situational awareness. We need to have a much better understanding of, again, where is this virus? How does it move? From whom? Under what circumstance? And in particular, when during the course of an illness is a person infectious? And to what degree do they transmit? All of those questions require that we be able to both detect the virus quickly and in, you know, in many, many people and settings, but it also is going to require that we understand who has been infected. And that's something that you do with a different kind of test that is not available now, and that's an antibody test. Mm. With an antibody test, you can say how many people have seen or been exposed to this virus, and only with that number can we figure out a true case fatality rate.
Yes, a true death rate. Though South Korea's testing blitz is being credited, at least for now, with what information they have, that they have a death rate that's under 1%. My understanding of what happened there was that immediately in mid-January, they began the process of working with biotech companies to come up with a test, which is why they have one that's fairly accurate. And the information that they've gathered has allowed them to see where the clusters are, has allowed them to be able to put resources in those places. I mean, it just raises the question of why we didn't do that here.
Yeah. We are certainly capable of doing it. And the Koreans have clearly shown the value of moving things out to the field rapidly and having a system for tracking results, quality controlling them, etc. We can do this. We know how to do it. We just got to, you know, get moving, get proper resources to do so, and then be coordinated in how it's done.
We're talking with Dr. David Relman, professor of medicine and of microbiology and immunology at Stanford University. He's also chief of infectious diseases at the Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System. We've also got Kevin Stark with us, a reporter for KQED Science, who's been following the latest developments in the Bay Area on the coronavirus. And you, our listeners, are with us. What questions do you have? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter, on Facebook at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Now, Kevin, meantime, they're supposed to be tracking all the people who disembarked in San Francisco on February 21st from the cruise ship that did that round trip to Mexico. What's the status of that?
Well, so the numbers are coming in, and we've been in contact with county health officials to find out exactly how many people in each county were on that ship. And we know in San Francisco, there's about 100 people. In Sonoma County, it's more than 70. And in Napa County, between 10 and 20. So we're getting the numbers in. We know that county health officials are trying to reach out to everyone to get them tested, to talk to them, to see if they've been feeling symptomatic, and to try and contain the spread if it is spreading. But we also know that they've been out in the community for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and there were thousands of people on that ship as well, and not all of them are from the Bay Area, right? I mean, they went home to wherever.
Absolutely, yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit more about Santa Clara County, saying that there are now 23 confirmed cases of the new coronavirus there?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot has been happening in the last day in Santa Clara County. They issued a new guidance for people living in the county They're saying that if you're planning a large gathering, a conference, party, to go ahead and to cancel it. And they're saying that businesses should start encouraging employees to work from home. If they are in the office, that they should really keep space between employees. So they're stepping up their containment and working into mitigation there. Additionally, we also know that a man in Santa Clara County yesterday died, and that he was on the Grand Princess cruise ship. County officials are testing him to see if he did have the coronavirus. We don't yet know. They're saying that they're going to let us know in the coming days. But we're still waiting for confirmation on that.
And seven of the emergency, or I don't know how many more there were, but people who responded to him, I understand, are in isolation out of fear that they may have been exposed as well. Before I go to calls, Dr. Bellman, we keep hearing that the risk to the immediate public is still low, yet we're hearing of all these stepped up guidance from county officials, say, in Santa Clara. I mean, should we still trust that assessment that it's low?
You know, this is really a tough question to answer. I think, you know, the true answer is going to always be someplace in the middle. People are now trying to play catch up a little bit and be properly anticipatory. And that can certainly lead to a lot of fear and anxiety, especially when we don't have good ground intelligence. You know, where is that virus, in whom, and how is it moving around? I think, you know, if you step back and say, look, this is something that is going to continue to evolve. We're going to have to deal with more cases. There are a couple of things that you should just remember. First, the vast majority of people who become infected are not seriously ill. It's a mild illness in about 80%. We know who is most at risk for having a more severe disease, and that's where we should be really focusing on protecting those hosts. Number two, there are some simple measures that have been repeated many times in the last few days about what one can do, having to do with personal, you know, sanitary practices, washing hands, and social distancing. And yet we're still having to learn a little bit better how to do that. People are not really washing hands as they should. And we're just going to have to start thinking about this more seriously and just adopt better practices.
Well, Russell tweets, do we know if coronavirus is any more or less contagious than the common cold and if people who are asymptomatic are contagious?
We don't really know. I would say there really aren't good data on that. There is a sense that that this virus may be a little bit more contagious, but it's also because cases are much more evident. So we're much more aware of these cases than we are of the common cold, and that causes us to have the impression that it may be a little more transmissible, but we just really don't know.
Well, Eliza in Oakland, join us. Hi, Eliza.
Hi, good morning. My question's for the man from Stanford. I understand he works for the university, but my younger brother's actually an oncology patient at the hospital at Stanford. I'm actually on my way right now to pick up another family member from the airport to go visit him. He's been recently admitted. He's severely immunocompromised. And I'm just curious what hospitals, specifically Stanford, I suppose, or others, are doing to protect their immunocompromised patients and what this social distancing that we're all being encouraged to do, how those of us who are, like, trying to support family members who are very sick should be considering if we're, you know, trying to balance that.
Thanks so much, Eliza. Dr. Wellman?
That's a very good question.
Yes.
And you've touched on some really important issues, and it goes back to a point that we talked about earlier, which is that we do know certain people are much more likely to have a more severe disease course, and it may be that your family member who is immunocompromised is in that group. For that very same reason, though, you need to know that centers like Stanford and all other hospitals have dealt with immunocompromised patients for a long time. And we have a pretty good idea of what it takes to protect them. Those measures are, if anything, even more enhanced right now. And so please be reassured that his welfare and those in his class, you know, his type of risk are being thought about very carefully.
Eliza, thanks for the question. And let me go next to Laura in Pleasanton. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I actually have two parts to my question. The beginning of the conversation, the guest was saying that pretty much if you think you've been exposed, you should be putting yourself into self-quarantine. It sounds like the cruise ship itself, we know that there's a situation. 45 tests are done out of a large population. By the criteria that the guest said, it sounds like we should just quarantine the ship for a period of time to be safe, because getting ahead of a situation of people getting off with possible exposure doesn't seem like it'd be more manageable.
Laura, thanks. Kevin Stark?
Yeah, you're kind of getting at what I think will be the big story today, which is what happens with the people that are on the cruise ship. And we haven't heard anything yet from officials. We're waiting for the test to come back. But once we do get that information, which we're expecting sometime this morning or this early afternoon, then the question is going to turn to what happens with the ship. It was originally supposed to port in San Francisco on Saturday, and I think we're just waiting to hear from officials if that will happen.
I interviewed a UC Berkeley epidemiologist Arthur Rheingold earlier this week, and he said anything with that number of people who could potentially have been exposed will be a Herculean effort. Laura, you said you had a second question?
Yes, my second question is, there's been a lot of discussion on the threat for immunocompromised people. So is this to say that the average person, maybe the younger population or people that are healthy, don't run a risk of having extreme complications?
David Relman.
It's a relative thing. No one has zero risk of a more severe course. But the big numbers say that on average, if you are, 40 or less and have no major underlying illness, and the types of illnesses that we know to be risky are well described, that if you're in that group, your likelihood of a mild disease or perhaps even asymptomatic disease course is quite good.
Well, Laura, thanks for the question. We're hearing from Mary, who was on the Grand Princess on February 21st. Mary writes, I left the Grand Princess on February 21st. Today is the 14th day. I am not sick, so I assume that means I was not infected. Am I right?
Yeah, this is David Relman. Not necessarily. I think we're going to learn that there is a much larger denominator of people out there, a larger number that have been infected and were not aware. They had an asymptomatic course.
Abby writes, since South Korea has such good tests, might they share those tests in the process of surrounding them with the U.S. healthcare system? And the processes surrounding them with the U.S. healthcare system, what is the context of the medical systems of the world? Do they share learnings? I think it's a really good question, David Relman, because I spoke with Congressman John Garamendi earlier this week, who was wondering why the government hadn't made more efforts to reach out to South Korea.
Yeah, this is a really interesting issue of how do we do this on a global scale. To answer the immediate question, I think the answer is that the issue here is not that we don't know how to design these tests and develop them. The challenge is deploying them, getting them out into the field, getting them to exactly where they're needed, and empowering those who can make good local decisions about where and how to use them to do so. That's the real issue here. But as far as the global governance issue goes, there are some important, I think, lessons that we still need to learn and have learned a bit about from Ebola and influenza, et cetera, which is that we have to be transparent about lessons learned, about information that is currently available across all the quarters of the globe, and learn how to share that much more quickly and effectively. And that's what WHO it was designed to do. That's what the international health regulations say each state party should do. But we still need to be doing that better.
Well, let me go next to Elizabeth in Belmont. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I was just wondering, one of my colleagues posited that maybe this really bad flu season where we didn't have a good vaccine could actually be just coronavirus and we just never tested for it. I would just really like to hear their thoughts on that. I have not heard that hypothesized anywhere.
Dr. Relman, what are the chances of that?
The data are pretty good that this virus first entered humans sometime in November, and it did so in China. There's really no evidence that the virus was elsewhere, although, and that's simply, dating back the origins of this virus based upon its sequences. But after that date, I think it's entirely possible and probable that people who had influenza-like illness certainly in China in December, and certainly elsewhere afterwards, that some of that is influenza, in fact.
Well, thank you for the question, Elizabeth. And let me go to Zach in San Francisco. Hi, Zach.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just curious if we know or if we have any data about how the virus affects newborn babies.
Newborn babies. Zach, thank you. David Roman, we've learned, of course, that children seem to be a little more resilient, but newborns?
Very little data. Actually, very few published cases of the infection in newborns. There is evidence that in China, children were infected. They generally developed a mild disease, but we think that many of them may have been even asymptomatic. It's a real kind of interesting puzzle.
Well, Kathy tweets, how safe are big concert venues like Chase Center? I can't get my adult kids to take this seriously. Casey asks, sort of related, given that health officials are already asking the public to avoid large social gatherings, what's the risk of going to the gym? Any thoughts for Kathy or Casey? David Roman?
Well, this is a very rapidly changing calculus and, you know, sort of cost-benefit assessment. Right now, there is a sense that where there is more evidence of community spread, large numbers of people should not be getting together in spaces, closed spaces like that. And so my sense right now is that events in places like Chase Center are going to have to be seriously questioned and may need to be postponed.
Well, just a couple of test-related questions, Dr. Relman. Karina asks, is it possible to still be a carrier even if you test negative for coronavirus? And how does the test actually identify a coronavirus victim? I mean, I think these are really good questions because we've heard about people who've tested negative, then positive, then negative. You know, so if you test negative, are you home free?
The general rule right now is that you need two negative consecutive tests to be called virus-free. And that's a reflection of the fact that no test is perfect. And especially when the level of virus gets down to just the lowest level of detection, then any test is going to be a little bit iffy. That's why we require two. But it's looking for virus, and it's looking for virus in the sample that you have on hand. We think right now that it's the nose and the throat that has the highest amount of virus, which is why it seems to be relatively contagious. So samples should be taken from those sites and tested sequentially in the manner I just mentioned. But that's not to say that the virus can't be in other body secretions, et cetera. It's just that it seems the amounts of virus are much lower.
It sounds like you're saying that the critical need right now is testing. And how concerned are you that Vice President Pence acknowledged yesterday that there's a shortfall in the number of kits required to meet demand? Now, NIH Director Anthony Fauci said that he believes they'll be able to ramp up to the need and meet the need in a couple of weeks. I mean, is that delay dangerous? And we just have 10 seconds, Dr. Fauci. I mean, Dr. Relman.
Thank you for that compliment. Yes, we'd like to have it sooner, but we do know that we will be able to ramp this up quickly. So I think 2 weeks is reasonable.
Well, thank you to you for joining us. David Relman is professor of medicine and of microbiology and immunology at Stanford. And thanks, Kevin Stark, for being with us today.
Thank you.
I know this story is really hard to cover. Kevin Stark, reporter with KQED Science. Thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.